There is so much discussion today. There's many good discussions in halacha and practical and many things we do throughout our Avodas HaKodesh. But there's a whole other side to this. And that is staying healthy physically. You know, I remember the first time I met Rabbi Elephant. I picked him up. I was living in Buffalo. And I picked him up to go visit Rich's. And he gets into my car and he sees the potato chips on the, you know, the potato chip bags and the pretzel. He says, "Oh, a mashkiach's car," you know. So that was, you know, physically and emotionally. And there are many, many nisyonis out there as we're on the road a lot in the Far East, where there are many, many nisyonis. Some of these discussions belong behind doors, privately. Some of these are ruchnius, but certainly there are many nisyonis when it comes to maintaining family lives. We would not be doing our job if we wouldn't address this and mechazik ourselves. So therefore, I thought it was apropos to ask from the leading experts. Are you here yourself? Okay. To address us on this. I've known Mr. David Mandel, I know him as Dudi, because he's my cousin, my whole life. And what could I say? A tremendous, tremendous individual. And we have many, many discussions together. He gives me a lot of chizuk. When I was in Eretz Yisrael Koilel, he was mechazik me a lot. So a lot of where I am today really is a tremendous yeshar koyach to him. So without further ado, my mother's going to hear about it, so I'll ask my cousin.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Fishbane. B'shus Rosh Yeshiva, and B'shus everyone. First, let me begin with a thank you. Okay. Let me begin with a thank you to all of you for all of the work that you do, for enabling all of us to have kashrus in our homes, in our travels, in our hotels, everywhere that we go. I have the occasion through my work to do a fair amount of traveling as you do, and being able to go to so many cities near and far, and seeing the brands and your work and everything, all the work that you do, always reminds us that things are not so simple, especially outside of New York or Eretz Yisrael. Begin with a thank you. The topic that my colleague, Dr. Norman Blumenthal, will be here in just a few minutes, and I were asked to speak about, is balancing family life with our all-consuming jobs. Yesterday, returning from another city, met someone on the plane, and as we debarked, walking towards the parking lot a few minutes, you make small talk. He said to me, "David, I know that you're involved in Ohel. I know that you do some of the work, but what else do you do? What other work do you do? How do you fill up your hours in the day?" So, you know, besides weather, you're not really sure what people can talk about in these inane conversations. And I thought to myself, weather would have been a much better subject for him, because here I am. For many years, I've been getting up at 4:30 in the morning, doing a certain amount of work in the morning when you're uninterrupted, go to sleep like you do fairly late. The day is full in between. And this gentleman so casually asks me, "So, how do you fill up your day? How do you fill up your time? What do you really do in your life?" I thought it was a good introduction for this morning. How many times are you asked, what do you really do for a living? Besides kashrus, besides traveling, besides 14 hours a day, what do you really do at work? Dr. Norman Blumenthal and I will each speak briefly, the amount of time that we have. I'm going to speak about some of the descriptions, some of the descriptors that maybe will identify each of us and give some suggestions on what we can do about them. Dr. Blumenthal, who's an expert in trauma, will talk about how to recognize trauma in ourselves with a small t. Not trauma with a capital T, but trauma with a small t. So I'm following a session on technology. Technology is such a big part of Kashrus today. So many advancements in technology have made our lives very busy. It's an understatement. Extremely busy. Much busier than we've ever been, much busier than we could have imagined 5, 10, 20, 30 years ago. And Kashrus has to stay one step ahead in the work that you do. It's made us, in some way, without creating a clinical diagnosis, obsessive neurotics. We're constantly thinking about it, we're constantly looking at it, we're constantly pushing ourselves. I don't know how many individuals in this room would fit into the category of the report that says that 70% of people touch their BlackBerries or iPhones as the last item before they go to sleep at night, and the same 70% of people touch their BlackBerries or iPhones first thing in the morning. Now, I can see from some of the smiles, usually I will ask people to raise their hands. I don't know if I have to ask people to raise their hands over here, but I can see from some of the smiles that maybe 70% in this room, it's an okay statistic. It's the last thing that we touch at night. Now, I'm not saying it to you to confirm a statistic. I'm saying it to you because it adds to our work. We want to see that last email. We want to respond to that last email. We want to see the news that's going on tomorrow morning on any one of the dozen websites that we might read. And it's the first thing that we look at in the morning. It adds to the tension that we bring upon ourselves. Biologically, chemistry-wise, there's a certain amount of energy that each one of us has. There's something called a reservoir of energy that each one of us has. That reservoir of energy enables us to work, to think, to talk. It's a biological, it's a chemistry concept. If you're like me, if you're a type A personality, if you're an overachiever, you know, we, all of us who have Yiddish mamas, and I mean this sincerely, I don't mean it as a joke. Rav Shalom Yehuda's grandmother, Aleha Shalom, and my mother, Zalzayin Gesund, were sisters. Several years apart, but identical in fiber in every single way. Each one of us had to be an overachiever. Each one of us had to accomplish. Every single one of us knows what that means. So if you're a type A personality, getting up at 4:30 or getting up at 5:30 and starting your day and continuing until 8 o'clock, 10 p.m., midnight, whatever it is, traveling in between, eating your snacks in the car, you're using up that capacity that you have in your body that is just so much. And without being able to replenish it, without being able to fill it, we run out of energy at some point. It's not a breakdown, chas v'shalom. We just get tired. We just get irritable. We get angry. We don't have time for people. We get impatient. And the worst possible situation is we make decisions that are not clear. We don't get all the information that we need. We answer a little bit too quickly. We press that send button, literally, before we're really sure of all the information that we should be responding. And then 10 minutes later, we do some type of a reset. I don't know how you work with your emails and your technology. What I like to do at the end of every single day, at night, I'll take 10 or 15 minutes and I'll reread all of the messages, all of the emails that I get during the day. Literally. It's many. It's as many as you get. You get more, you get less, it doesn't make a difference. 30, 50, 100, 150, I take 15 minutes, I reread all of them. Almost without fail, there's at least one that I didn't handle well. I answered too quickly, or I forgot to answer completely, and hopefully I didn't miss some deadline, a piece of information that someone was looking for. We just can't keep up with ourselves. So that's one small eitzah. How did I handle this in my personal life? If we're all similar to each other, how did I handle this? So let me talk personally before I give you suggestions that may or may not be good for you, and I'll tell you a personal story. I like to tell people that Baruch Hashem, in the 18 years that I'm at Ohel, I've never had one bad day. It's absolutely incredible. It's an amazing, amazing, amazing job. Baruch Hashem. And I have had the privilege of getting to know Rabbi Gonish and Rebbetzin Gonish and Rav David Cohen, the Mor D'Asra, and people tell me, how did my life change when I joined Ohel? And I tell them my phone book. They said, what does that mean? I said, the single biggest change in my life since I joined Ohel is my phone book. I have phone numbers of Rabbanim, Rosh Yeshivas, Gedolei Hador, that we speak with through the work at Ohel that I've never had the opportunity to do. It has changed my life, all for the positive in so many different ways. And Baruch Hashem, it's all come through Ohel, through Hashem sending me up, making a shidduch with Ohel. So it changed my life in many ways. I've never had one bad day, Baruch Hashem. I've had hard days. I've had difficult days. But I've never had a day that I haven't wanted to get up and go to work. That's the difference between a bad day and a difficult day. So about a year after my daughter was born, Baruch Hashem, Hashem Yehuda knows well, about a year after when I joined Ohel, my daughter was born, I turned around to myself and I said, what am I doing? What am I doing? I'm working 10, 12, 14-hour days. I'm not home for the first sound. I'm not home for the first call. I'm not home for this. I'm always busy. Call you back in 5 minutes. And then 30 minutes later, call you back in 5 minutes. But I was doing my work. Everybody tells us at Ohel that we're doing Hashem's work. Wonderful. I was doing Hashem's work. We were doing Hashem's work. But I also wasn't doing the part of Hashem that tells me what my responsibilities are. So I made a pshara with myself, and I don't know whether I'm on tape or not, I'm speaking very openly, that I'm going to be home at least every single day for breakfast or for dinner. Now, breakfast doesn't literally mean having a three-course meal. You understand, it means being home in the morning in time or being home in the evening for dinner. There's a famous study that talks about that the more time families spend having dinner together, the less family problems that will result, especially they tied it into adolescents at risk. People will argue that point. The issue, of course, is not having a meal together. The issue is just spending time together looking and talking. So I made up sure with myself, either good morning or good evening, spending time together. The other decision, which I believe was a very important decision, which is a strong recommendation to this group, is milestones. There are certain milestones in life that happen only once, with children and with grandchildren. And if we miss that milestone, it doesn't come back again. The first sitter, graduation from kindergarten, pre-1A. When your son or your daughter says to you, Tati, can we please this Sunday? Tati, can we please tonight? And we miss that email, and we miss that answer. We are not only not replenishing our reservoir that we have a limited amount of. We've done a tremendous avlo in our relationship that accumulates. There were lyrics written about 20 years ago. Forgive my use of a non-Jewish person to quote his lyrics by Harry Chapin. I see some nodding of the heads. His lyrics were so clear what he talks about. When I was a young father and my son was born, I wasn't there. I was working. When my son was 8 years old and he said, "Daddy, can we go play ball together? Can we do it tomorrow, son? I don't have time today." When my son was 16, he said, "Daddy, can I have the car keys, please?" Our daughter, Baruch Hashem, just started driving. No one can prepare you for that oh my gosh moment. No one can prepare you for that oh my gosh moment. That's trauma with a capital T. When my son was 16, he said, "Daddy, can I have the car keys, please?" I retired, and I called my son, and I said, "Can we spend some time together, please?" And my son said, "Daddy, I don't really have time right now. Can we do it another day?" The story, excuse my expression, is godless. Excuse my expression. When we don't have time for them, they don't have time for us. So this is about how we replenish ourselves, how we rebuild that reservoir of energy of which we only have a certain amount of. And may I strongly recommend, and I urge everyone in this room, and I'm sure you've heard this kind of advice before, do not read blogs. I can't begin to tell you how much healthier you will be if you don't read blogs, any blogs, and certainly not the insanity of the individuals that comment on it. There's absolutely nothing redeeming about it. Zero. Zero. Because the only thing that it does is it'll create some tension in you. Because 99% of them are negative, and they're narishkeit, and they're useless. That's the reservoir of energy that we're talking about. One of my mentors, who I speak about often, like to say that life's most complicated questions have the easiest answers. We tend to go searching for complicated answers to complicated questions. And he said that it's right in front of us. I want to give you a good story, an example of what he's talking about. I was with a colleague in Eretz Yisrael. She has two children, secular Jew. She has two daughters. She was lamenting, she was asking how she might reconnect with her daughter. They live in Tel Aviv. You see, the question that she was asking me was that she has a 19-year-old daughter who was looking for God. She was looking for God. Her daughter left Eretz Yisrael to join a group of Tibetans to go search for God, for the meaning of life. And she said to me, this secular Jew said to me, "My daughter left Eretz Yisrael to go search for Hashem." Where people go up to the mountains, 20, 30,000 feet high. And she was saying, the answer was right here. Where's my daughter going? The answer was in Eretz Yisrael. If you don't find Hashem in Eretz Yisrael, if you don't find God in Eretz Yisrael, you're not finding God any place in the world. That's what I think my boss was saying. How do you fill up the reservoir of energy, the limited amount that we have? How do we spend time with our family? How do we relax? How do we make sure that we're not that irritable during the day? How do we not miss an important question from the most important people in our lives? The answer was really very simple. We did not need Rabbi Fishbein to ask Dr. Norman Blumenthal and I to give you the answers. But every once in a while, just like we read, excuse the analogy, Just like we read Sefer Bereishis and Sefer Shemot and Sefer Vayikra and Sefer Bamidbar and Sefer Devarim every single week, every single year, over and over again, to remind us, we need to go back and remind ourselves of the things that work for us. That's our message for the day. The answer to replenish ourselves, to take a break from ourselves, to make sure that we spend time relaxing so we can do the hard work every single day that we do, is to do it. Chazara, don't read the blogs. Chazara, don't miss the milestones. 6 months, 14 months, son, daughter, grandson, granddaughter, whoever that is, you can never make them up again. 4 years, 6 years. Go home and ask the question tonight, if you would, to your wives. Go home and ask the question. Be brave about it. If I missed anything important in the last 6 months, in the last year, where I should have been there, if you're prepared for a good answer, seriously, tell me you went to a conversation today in which this was discussed. How can I improve? Give me one area that I could be better at relaxing and enjoying our family. You're going to get a really, really good, clear answer. And it could be very helpful. And it may surprise you how easy it is. Dr. Blumenthal will speak about recognizing trauma within ourselves, early warning signs, trauma as we describe it with a small t. My colleague, Dr. Norman Blumenthal, Director of Trauma, Bereavement, and Crisis Intervention at OHEL.
Thank you very much, David and Rabbi Fishbein. Thank you. I have to tell you that looking here and seeing what an illustrious group of individuals are seeing to it that what I eat is kosher is humbling. And if in some small measure my words today can pay back the favor for what you do for us, then it's well worth it. Much in the tradition of Rava, I like to always start with a witty or amusing story, and happens to be that the one that fits with what I want to talk about today is one of my favorite. I did my internship at what's known as Hillside Hospital, which is the psychiatric hospital of North Shore Long Island Jewish, or Long Island Goyish, as I've called it. I haven't figured out what's Jewish about the place. And Hillside is one of the, in fact, Hillside predates North Shore and Long Island Jewish. It's been around about, I think, 100 years already, today known as Zucker Hillside Hospital. And the chief psychiatrist at Hillside, when I was an intern in 77 to 78, was a fellow Lou Robbins. Lou was the patriarch of Hillside. I mean, he died about a year or two after my internship. But he was, like, really the patriarch of Hillside. And Hillside Hospital was, at the time, very progressive. It was the first psychiatric hospital to get rid of the white coats, where the doctors and patients dressed comparably. And Lou was once showing somebody around the hospital, and the guest noted that the patients and staff were dressed in the same way. He said, how do you tell the difference between patients and staff? And Lou said, the patients get better. I'm going to tell you a story in which a psychologist did not get better. The psychologist is Norman Blumenthal. This goes back a few years, and I should just first give you a little description of my life. I have four jobs. Half-time director of trauma, bereavement, and crisis intervention for OHEL. I have a small private practice. I teach and supervise still at Hillside Hospital. I run the group therapy training for residents and psychiatrists. And I also teach and run a program at Yeshiva University on Fridays. I run the Friday portion of the Wexner, Kol Elyon, and Smicha Honors program. And I co-teach a course in pastoral psychology, which is a survey course covering different areas in psychology for Rabbanim. I co-teach it with David Pelkovitz. He gets half the class once fall, and I get half the other half fall, and we switch for the spring semester. So my days have to be pretty organized, and they are organized. I officially get up at 5:30. I try to make it to the 5:45 Chabura, where I learn. I'm usually there around 6. Daven about 6:35, 6:40, depending on the day. Get home around 7:30. Can have a breakfast, and I'm out by 8 o'clock. Fridays, when I have to go up to YU, it's a little different. Because we have a highway here, for those of you out of town, known as the Van Wick. We call it the Van Quick. It barely moves, and so if I leave any later than 7:40, I won't make it in time to YU. So my Friday is the same schedule, get up 5:30, get home around 7:30. My wife usually prepares a bagel and a coffee for me, wash, make a motzi, run out, call my parents from the car in Israel to wish them a good Shabbos, and go up to YU. This morning, or this particular day that I'm going to describe, Murphy's Law was in full force. The night before, I looked over my PowerPoints for the next day's course. I tweaked them. You know, I always try to fix them up a little bit, update them, send them out to the students. Next morning, I don't know if I didn't set the alarm, if the alarm was set and I didn't hear it, whatever. But next thing I know, instead of waking up 5:30, I look at the clock and it's 6:45. So jump out of bed, run, try to make the 7 o'clock minyan. By the time Kiddush is finished and Chazor HaShatz, I'm already wrapping up my tefillin because I got to get up to YU. Come home, get my bagel and coffee. I mean, some things I don't forget. By the time I got out, I don't remember why. It was already 7:50. That's really tight. Run out, get into the car, of course, forget my briefcase, which has my laptop and my PowerPoint and my little laser pointer and all the things I need to teach. Forget to call my parents. Come racing into YU exactly on time for the class. I have to go online to the email that I sent the guys to download my PowerPoint because I didn't have it handy. It was a crazy day. It was absolutely crazy. Everything went wrong. And finally, when I went home that afternoon, I'm driving home and trying to figure out, you know, what's going on. I had all sorts of excuses. Well, shortly after the Yom Tov, I haven't adjusted to the full week of work. I had all sorts of excuses. And then it hit me like a ton of bricks. About 3 weeks earlier, I got a call from a young woman who's a postdoc intern in psychology whom I was supervising. Frantic call. One of her patients who I was supervising the case had committed suicide. She desperately, obviously, wanted to see me. She came in to see me, shook up. Very distressing story, very distressing situation. And I got into full supervisor mode. I explained to her, I pointed out to her, she only had 3 sessions with him. I reminded her that after the second session, when he expressed suicidal ideation, we arranged for him to get an immediate psychiatric, how the psychiatrist said he didn't have to be hospitalized, psychiatrist had him on antidepressants. I reminded her of all the literature and how suicidal behavior is genetic, how poor general we are in predicting such behavior, even the biggest experts can't predict. I reminded her of a seminar I took when I was an intern on suicide and how the instructor kept reminding us that, you know, we're in many ways like oncologists and cardiologists. Sometimes our patients have fatal diseases and we may not be able to save them. And we discussed what they call postvention, how to deal with the family afterwards. I went to sleep that night. I felt fine. I was a supervisor. I took care of it. 3 weeks later, that day, that fateful Friday, the subject in my pastoral psychology class was suicide. And I had a breakdown. Why am I telling you this story? Because in many respects relates very much to what you do and stress at work in general. Point number one, I was a supervisor. You're administrators. Administrators, supervisors, they can't have a breakdown. They can't have stress. They're responsible for other people. They're supposed to manage other people's stress. I often like to quote Harry Stack Sullivan, who was the founder of the American School of Psychiatry. And he used to say about psychotherapy, he says, when you're doing therapy, there should be only one anxious person in the room, and preferably not the therapist. So you really have to be in control. You can't have a meltdown. You can't let that stress in because you're responsible, just like I was the supervisor, and you put it away. But the other part of the story, and that's what I may hopefully be made the main message that I'll give over to you. David, I love the demarcation, so I'm going to use it. David often talks about trauma with a capital T and trauma with a small t. The trauma with a capital T, we all know. One of the most graphic examples happened a few blocks from here on 9/11. When something catastrophic happens, it throws you for a loop. But in some respects, that's the easier trauma. Because you understand. It's okay. You understand if you're upset. You understand if you're distressed. You understand if you're anxious. And everybody else does too. You got a ton of communal support. If there's something, God forbid, catastrophic or untoward that happens to you that's of such magnitude, the world rallies, your friend, the community, they rally behind you for about 4 days, but they rally behind you. Then there's the other trauma with the tall small t. That's the trauma of the situation that I was in, where we don't face it. We don't allow ourselves to face it. Or even maybe more pernicious, it's that, like Chinese water torture. It's that stressor that in and of itself, each individual event is not so destabilizing, but cumulatively, it catches up with you. The boss that just keeps adding on a little bit more work for you. The coworker who's just annoying, doesn't do anything blatant or flagrant annoying. Or the mashgiach under your charge, who's just on that boundary of being a little sloppy, careless, not so much so you're going to let him go and have to worry about his parnassah and his 11 children, but causing you endless aggravation. And it's not each event. It's day in and day out, and it catches up with you. And then it's like a sucker punch. It blindsides you, just like I was blindsided on that Friday morning. Because I didn't face it, because I didn't realize that it was a trauma, even secondarily, it was a trauma for me what had happened. It stayed there, it didn't go away, and it caught me from behind. It surprised me and threw me off for a day. And that's the kind of trauma we have to watch out for, and that's the kind of trauma. And sometimes you'll have the very same experience that I had. There'll be, suddenly you don't want to get up in the morning. Suddenly you're forgetting things. Suddenly you're short. And it could be not only just at work, it could be at home too. Again, not, God forbid, those unthinkable, horrible situations. But it could be just having an adolescent kid. Or maybe being in the shidduch parsha, lo aleinu. You know, all those kind of stressors. That's in and of itself, but day in and day out eat away at you. Let me conclude with one other important point, which is very relevant, and it's something that's driving me crazy being in this field, particularly being in this field in the frum community. There's a word in the English language that I would like to get rid of, at least for us frum Jews, and that's called strong. And I can't, a day doesn't go by where I don't hear it. And what we call strong in the Orthodox community means being stoic, being unfeeling. Maybe being a Kalta Litvak, or I'll draw on my background, being a Yekka. Right, you know, everybody knows how you can tell the difference between, in Frankfurt, how you tell the difference between Purim and Tisha B'Av, right? Sneakers. Anyway, but you know, I'm one of them. Yeah. But that's what we call strong. That's not strength. And I can't tell you, anytime someone comes in, they just had, again, I don't even want to say the kind of things that you can imagine, types of things that we hear about at Ohel, and that my department in particular deals with. And someone comes in, just something so unthinkable happened. But I'm strong. I'm stronger, he's stronger, she's stronger, they're stronger. We didn't cry, we didn't. That's not being strong. Let me tell you what being strong means. Being strong means being upset, being scared, being anxious, allowing those feelings in and dealing with them. That's being strong. It's crying and dealing with the tears. That's being strong. I remember, again, I won't say specifics, I remember one woman calling me again, one of those unthinkable situations, a sudden death of a loved one, hot, not at all expected. And she was on the phone and she said, I feel so weak, I can't even push the door in the department stores. Those round, I can't push them either, I don't know what she was saying, but you know, those doors, I'm so weak. I said, that's because you're strong. She said, what do you mean? It just came to me, I was talking to her, I said, I gave her a muscle. Imagine the strongest man in the world. Okay, let's say one of these Russian weightlifters, you know, they have steroids for breakfast, steroids for lunch, and steroids for supper, all with the OU and the CRC, and they're, you know, right? You know, they have muscles all over the place, and he's going to break the world record. He's going to, I don't know, lift the chvais 900 pounds. I don't know what the world record is, right? And he's collapsing, and he's sweating, and the veins are popping out, and he's out of breath, and he just about gets the thing up, he throws it on the floor, and he faints. Is he weak or is he strong? And that's the, so I said to her, you're facing the enormity of what happened to you. You're dealing with it. So you're strong. You're exhausted, but you're strong. And that's what strength is. Maybe it's a chutzpah on my part in this crowd. Maybe it's the end of the Dvar Torah, so I'll ask with Rishus. And I believe it's a Hirsch, but being my background, I'll give it to him anyway. But there's a question and coming up very soon when Yaakov makes a vow with Lavan. He says, "B'pachad aviv Yitzchak." He does it with, literally translated, the fear of Yitzchak. Some say it translated as the awe of Yitzchak. But why the fear? Yitzchak's Yemida is Gevura. Why the fear? And I think, again, I believe it's what Rav Hirsch says, I'm paraphrasing a bit. Imagine during that Kedah it was possible to shut off Yitzchak's fear. Now, fear is controlled in part of the brain. When a certain part of the brain is damaged, you don't feel fear. There's even a machala, it's mostly in Japan, very rare, of children who the pain center of their brain doesn't work. And they're in great danger. They put their hands in fire, they run into, they don't feel any pain. So imagine that during that Kedah, Avram Avinu could have shut off Yitzchak's fear. It wouldn't have been in the Nisayon. And that's what Yaakov is saying. Yitzchak was afraid, but he did it anyway. And at the critical moment when Yaakov was fleeing Lavan and facing Esav and facing such uncertainty, he too said, I'm afraid, but I'm drawing upon the strength of my father Yitzchak. And we have to remember that as well, that that's the measure of strength. Allow the stress in, feel the pressure, and then how do you address it? I hope that was helpful, and I think we're available for few minutes, questions and things like that. Good. Or just my pleasure. Okay.
Yeah, we do have time for a few questions about how to manage life.
The question was, how do you deal with email fatigue? I've been doing emails as long as you have, And about a month ago, I did something for the first time. I couldn't catch up. I couldn't catch up with the emails. And I knew that I was chas v'shalom 3 or 4 hours behind. Not a day behind or a week behind. I was a few hours behind. And you know, you always have some colleagues that send you new. Somebody invariably sends you a new. So that night, I did my usual review, chazara, and I decided to send out an email that I had never done before. Normally, I would sit there and I would very patiently respond to things that I missed, and then I would spend however long it takes me, and I would feel like I go to sleep every single night. Every single night, I did not miss any emails. That night, for the first time, I sent out a note that I said, I want to apologize to all my colleagues. I may be a few hours behind on my email responses. Tomorrow, I may be a day behind on my email responses. You remember that email?
I didn't have time to read it.
So I apologize in advance. If there was anything important that you asked me that I missed, please ask me again. Emphasize important. If there was anything important that you asked me that I missed, please ask me again. I don't know how many emails you get. I get 130, 140 a day. I don't know whether that's a little or a lot. Doesn't make a difference. I will tell you that not one colleague sent me a note saying this was important. Now, probably what happened is everyone said, Dave, Nebuch, David is so tired. He's overwhelmed. He's having a breakdown. He's not feeling well. Look at this email, because I'd never sent out anything like that. I was just trying to say, I'll catch up. If there's anything important, ask me again. That's how I dealt with it. But it took me a long time to get to that. You don't have to respond to everything just because someone sent it to you at 2:02. It doesn't have to be answered by 2:04. Usually people in the subject heading will say, important, urgent, or they'll flag it. It can wait an hour. It can wait a couple of hours. Anybody else have a different idea for how to deal with email fatigue? There's another way. Turn off your iPhone. Turn off your BlackBerry for an hour during dinner. I credit my wife saying to me, whoever it is, is less important than what we're doing right now, having a meal together. Whoever it is less important than having a meal together with the family. Yes, sir. Everyone hear the question? Sometimes the Mashgiach job is so important that they can't turn off the email. So I'll give you my comment, and Dr. Blumenthal can give you his. My comment is, then distinguish between the important and the unimportant. Everything cannot be equally important. It's impossible. So if you get 100 of those questions, you can determine on your own which ones have to be answered within the hour. And if it doesn't, don't answer it. Get into the habit of not answering it and get back to it a little bit later. You now bought yourself 30 seconds or 1 minute to do something with that minute, something else.
I just want to mention that that's a very important point, and I want to just explain something that happens psychologically. When there's an emergency or a crisis, we have a psychological adrenaline rush. In other words, we are capable of being incredibly alert and on top of things in a very specific time, when even when we're sleep deprived. I mean, talk to any resident in an emergency room. I can tell you that when she was here, to acknowledge it. We can focus. But what happened? Here's the important point: when the emergency is over, if you're on the site and you have to be on top of everything, or a very important email comes and you got to really concentrate and take care of something, you'll have that rush and you'll be focused. It's afterwards that it catches up with you. A little bit like, I'm sure we've all had the experience. We've driven very long at night, and we're focused, and then as soon as we pull into the driveway, you just want to collapse. So that's just I would tell you to be careful then if you have a situation like that, is your post-emergency response. That's when it catches up with you.
Okay. Thank you again. Wonderful. Thank you. It's our COVID.